trace of the smell off my skin. The smell makes me feel sick. But also I'm hungry. This is monstrous, but nevertheless it's true. Death makes me hungry. Maybe it's because I've been emptied. Or maybe it's the body's way of seeing to it that I remain alive, continue to repeat its bedrock prayer. I am. I am. I am still. I want to go to bed, make love right now. I think of the word relish. I could eat a horse. Chapter 44. Things are back to normal. How can I call this normal? But compared with this morning, it is normal. For lunch, there was a cheese sandwich on brown bread, a glass of milk, celery sticks, canned pears. A school child's lunch. I ate everything up, not quickly, but reveling in the taste, the flavors lush on my tongue. Now I am going shopping, the same as usual. I even look forward to it. There's a certain consolation to be taken from routine. I go out the back door, along the path. Nick is washing the car, his hat on sideways. He doesn't look at me. We avoid looking at each other these days. Surely we'd give something away by it, even out here in the open, with no one to see. I wait at the corner for Ev Glenn. She's late. At last I see her coming, a red and white shape of cloth, like a kite, walking at the steady pace we've all learned to keep. I see her and notice nothing at first. Then, as she comes nearer, I think that there must be something wrong with her. She looks wrong. She's altered in some indefinable way. She's not injured. She's not limping. It's as if she has shrunk. Then, when she's nearer still, I see what it is. She isn't Ev Glenn. She's the same height, but thinner, and her face is beige, not pink. She comes up to me, stops. "Blessed be the fruit," she says, straight-faced, straight-laced. "May the Lord open," I reply. I try not to show surprise. "You must be a Fred," she says. I say yes, and we begin our walk. Now what, I think. My head is churning. This is not good news. What has become of her? How do I find out without showing too much concern? We aren't supposed to form friendships, loyalties among one another. I try to remember how much time Ev Glenn has to go at her present posting. "We've been sent good weather," I say, which I receive with joy. The voice placid, flat, unrevealing. We pass the first checkpoint without saying anything further. She's taciturn, but so am I. Is she waiting for me to start something? Reveal myself? Or is she a believer, engrossed in inner meditation? "Has Ev Glenn been transferred so soon?" I ask. But I know she hasn't. I saw her only this morning. She would have said. "I am Ev Glenn," the woman says. Word perfect. And of course she is, the new one. And Ev Glenn, wherever she is no longer Ev Glenn. I never did know her real name. That is how you can get lost in a sea of names. It wouldn't be easy to find her now. We go to Milk and Honey and to All Flesh, where I buy chicken and the new Ev Glenn gets 3 pounds of hamburger. There are the usual lines. I see several women I recognize, exchange with them the infinitesimal nods with which we show each other we are known, at least to someone. We still exist. Outside All Flesh, I say to the new Ev Glenn, "We should go to the wall." I don't know what I expect from this. Some way of testing her reaction, perhaps. I need to know whether or not she is one of us. If she is, if I can establish that, perhaps she'll be able to tell me what has really happened to Ev Glenn. "As you like," she says. Is that indifference or caution? On the wall hang the 3 women from this morning, still in their dresses, still in their shoes, still with the white bags over their heads. Their arms have been untied and are stiff and proper at their sides. The blue one is in the middle, the 2 red ones on either side, though the colors are no longer as bright, They seem to have faded, grown dingy, like dead butterflies or tropical fish drying on land. The gloss is off them. We stand and look at them in silence. "Let that be a reminder to us," says the new of Glenn, finally. I say nothing at first, because I'm trying to make out what she means. She could mean that this is a reminder to us of the unjustness and brutality of the regime. In that case, I ought to say yes. Or she could mean the opposite, that we should remember to do what we are told and not get into trouble, because if we do, we will be rightfully punished. If she means that, I should say, praise be. Her voice was bland, toneless, no clues there. I take a chance. Yes, I say. To this she does not respond, although I sense a flicker of white at the edge of my vision, as if she's looked quickly at me. After a moment, we turn away and begin the long walk back, matching our steps in the approved way, so that we seem to be in unison. I think maybe I should wait before attempting anything further. It's too soon to push, to probe. I should give it a week, 2 weeks, maybe longer. Watch her carefully. Listen for tones in her voice, unguarded words, the way of Glenn listened to me. Now that of Glenn is gone, I am alert again. My sluggishness has fallen away. My body is no longer for pleasure only, but senses its jeopardy. I should not be rash. I should not take unnecessary risks. But I need to know. I hold back until we're past the final checkpoint, and there are only blocks to go, but then I can no longer control myself. I didn't know of Glenn very well, I say. I mean the former one. Oh, she says. The fact that she said anything, however guarded, encourages me. I've only known her since May, I say. I can feel my skin growing hot, my heart speeding up. This is tricky. For one thing, it's a lie. And how do I get from there to the next vital word? Around the 1st of May, I think it was. What they used to call May Day. Did they? She says. Light. Indifferent. Menacing. That isn't a term I remember. I'm surprised you do. You ought to make an effort, she pauses, to clear your mind of such... She pauses again. Echoes. Now I feel cold, seeping over my skin like water. What she is doing is warning me. She isn't one of us, but she knows. I walk the last blocks in terror. I've been stupid again, more than stupid. It hasn't occurred to me before, but now I see. If of Glenn's been caught, of Glenn may talk about me among others. She will talk. She won't be able to help it. But I haven't done anything, I tell myself. Not really. All I did was know. All I did was not tell. They know where my child is. What if they bring her, threaten something to her in front of me? Or do it? I can't bear to think what they might do. Or Luke. What if they have Luke? Or my mother, or Moira, or almost anyone. Dear God, don't make me choose. I would not be able to stand it, I know that. Moira was right about me. I'll say anything they like. I'll incriminate anyone. It's true. The first scream, whimper, even, and I'll turn to jelly. I'll confess to any crime. I'll end up hanging from a hook on the wall. Keep your head down, I used to tell myself, and see it through. It's no use. This is the way I talk to myself on the way home. At the corner, we turn to one another in the usual way. Under his eye, says the new, treacherous of Glenn. Under his eye, I say, trying to sound fervent. As if such play-acting could help, now that we've come this far. Then she does an odd thing. She leans forward so that the stiff white blinkers on her heads are almost touching, so that I can see her pale beige eyes up close, the delicate web of lines across her cheeks, and whispers, very quickly, her voice faint as dry leaves. "She hanged herself," she says, "after the salvaging. She saw the van coming for her. It was better." Then she's walking away from me down the street. Chapter 45. I stand a moment, emptied of air, as if I've been kicked. So she's dead, and I am safe after all. She did it before they came. I feel a great relief. I feel thankful to her. She has died that I may live. I will mourn later. Unless this woman is lying, there's always that. I breathe in, deeply, breathe out, giving myself oxygen. The space in front of me blackens, then clears. I can see my way. I turn, open the gate, keeping my hand on it a moment to steady myself, walk in. Nick is there, still washing the car, whistling a little. He seems very far away. "Dear God," I think, "I will do anything you like. Now that you've let me off, I'll obliterate myself, if that's what you really want. I'll empty myself, truly, become a chalice. I'll give up Nick. I'll forget about the others. I'll stop complaining. I'll accept my lot. I'll sacrifice. I'll repent. I'll abdicate. I'll renounce. I know this can't be right, but I think it anyway. Everything they taught at the Red Center, everything I've resisted, comes flooding in. I don't want pain. I don't want to be a dancer, my feet in the air, my head a faceless oblong of white cloth. I don't want to be a doll hung up on the wall. I don't want to be a wingless angel. I want to keep on living in any form. I resign my body freely to the uses of others. They can do what they like with me. I am abject. I feel, for the first time, their true power. I go along past the flower beds, the willow tree, aiming for the back door. I will go in. I will be safe. I will fall on my knees in my room, gratefully breathe in lungfuls of the stale air, smelling of furniture polish. Serena Joy has come out of the front door. She's standing on the steps. She calls to me. What is it she wants? Does she want me to go into the sitting room and help her wind gray wool? I won't be able to hold my hand steady. She'll notice something. But I walk over to her anyway, since I have no choice. On the top step, she towers above me. Her eyes flare, hot blue against the shriveled white of her skin. I look away from her face, down at the ground, at her feet, the tip of her cane. "I trusted you," she says. "I tried to help you." Still, I don't look up at her. Guilt pervades me. I've been found out. But for what? For which of my many sins am I accused? The only way to find out is to keep silent. To start excusing myself now for this or that would be a blunder. I could give away something she hasn't even guessed. It might be nothing. It might be the match hidden in my bed. I hang my head. "Well?" she asks. "Nothing to say for yourself?" I look up at her. "About what?" I manage to stammer. As soon as it's out, it sounds impudent. "Look," she says. She brings her free hand from behind her back. It's her cloak she's holding, the winter one. "There was lipstick on it," she says. "How could you be so vulgar? I told him." She drops the cloak. She's holding something else, her hand all bone. She throws that down as well. The purple sequins fall, slithering down over the step like snakeskin, glittering in the sunlight. "Behind my back," she says. "You could have left me something." Does she love him, after all? She raises her cane. I think she's going to hit me, but she doesn't. "Pick up that disgusting thing and get to your room. Just like the other one, a slut. You'll end up the same." I stoop, gather. Behind my back, Nick has stopped whistling. I want to turn, run to him, throw my arms around him. This would be foolish. There is nothing he can do to help. He too would drown. I walk to the back door, into the kitchen, set down my basket, go upstairs. I am orderly and calm. 15. Night. Chapter 46. I sit in my room, at the window, waiting. In my lap is a handful of crumpled stars. This could be the last time I have to wait. But I don't know what I'm waiting for. "What are you waiting for?" they used to say. That meant hurry up. No answer was expected. "For what are you waiting?" is a different question, and I have no answer for that one either. Yet it isn't waiting, exactly. It's more like a form of suspension, without suspense. At last, there is no time. I am in disgrace, which is the opposite of grace. I ought to feel worse about it. But I feel serene, at peace, pervaded with indifference. "Don't let the bastards grind you down." I repeat this to myself, but it conveys nothing. You might as well say, "Don't let there be air," or "Don't be." I suppose you could say that. There's nobody in the garden. I wonder if it will rain. Outside, the light is fading. It's reddish already. Soon it will be dark. Right now it's darker. That didn't take long. There are a number of things I could do. I could set fire to the house, for instance. I could bundle up some of my clothes and the sheets and strike my one hidden match. If it didn't catch, that would be that. But if it did, there would at least be an event, a signal of some kind to mark my exit, a few flames easily put out. In the meantime, I could let loose clouds of smoke and die by suffocation. I could tear my bedsheet into strips and twist it into a rope of sorts and tie one end to the leg of my bed and try to break the window, which is shatterproof. I could go to the commander, fall on the floor, my hair disheveled, as they say, grab him around the knees, confess, weep, implore. "Nolite te bastardes, carborundorum," I could say. Not a prayer. I visualize his shoes, black, well-shined, impenetrable, keeping their own counsel. Instead, I could noose the bedsheet round my neck, hook myself up in the closet, throw my weight forward, choke myself off. I could hide behind the door, wait until she comes, hobbles along the hall, bearing whatever sentence, penance, punishment, jump out at her, knock her down, kick her sharply and accurately in the head, to put her out of her misery and myself as well, to put her out of our misery. It would save time. I could walk at a steady pace down the stairs and out the front door and along the street, trying to look as if I knew where I was going and see how far I could get. Red is so visible. I could go to Nick's room, over the garage, as we have done before. I could wonder whether or not he would let me in, give me shelter, now that the need is real. I consider these things idly. Each one of them seems the same size as all the others. Not one seems preferable. Fatigue is here, in my body, in my legs and eyes. That is what gets you in the end. Faith is only a word, embroidered. I look out at the dusk and think about its being winter. The snow falling, gently, effortlessly, covering everything in soft crystal. The mist of moonlight before a rain, blurring the outlines, obliterating color. Freezing to death is painless, they say, after the first chill. You lie back in the snow like an angel made by children and go to sleep. Behind me I feel her presence, my ancestress, my double, turning in mid-air under the chandelier, In her costume of stars and feathers, a bird stopped in flight, a woman made into an angel, waiting to be found. By me, this time. How could I have believed I was alone in here? There were always two of us. Get it over, she says. I'm tired of this melodrama. I'm tired of keeping silent. There's no one you can protect. Your life has value to no one. I want it finished. As I'm standing up, I hear the black van. I hear it before I see it. Blended with the twilight, it appears out of its own sound like a solidification, a clotting of the night. It turns into the driveway, stops. I can just make out the white eye, the two wings. The paint must be phosphorescent. Two men detach themselves from the shape of it, come up the front steps, ring the bell. I hear the bell toll, ding-dong, like the ghost of a cosmetics woman down in the hall. Worse is coming, then. I've been wasting my time. I should have taken things into my own hands while I had the chance. I should have stolen a knife from the kitchen, found some way to the sewing scissors. There were the garden shears, the knitting needles. The world is full of weapons if you're looking for them. I should have paid attention. But it's too late to think about that now. Already their feet are on the dusty rose carpeting of the stairs, a heavy, muted tread, pulse in the forehead. My back's to the window. I expect a stranger, but it's Nick who pushes open the door, flicks on the light. I can't place that unless he's one of them. There was always that possibility. Nick, the private eye. Dirty work is done by dirty people. You shit, I think. I open my mouth to say it, but he comes over, close to me, whispers. It's all right. It's May Day. Go with them. He calls me by my real name. Why should this mean anything? Them, I say. I see the two men standing behind him, the overhead light in the hallway making skulls of their heads. You must be crazy. My suspicion hovers in the air above him. A dark angel warning me away. I can almost see it. Why shouldn't he know about May Day? All the eyes must know about it. They'll have squeezed it, crushed it, twisted it out of enough bodies, enough mouths by now. Trust me, he says, which, in itself, has never been a talisman, carries no guarantee. But I snatch at it, this offer. It's all I'm left with. One in front, one behind. They escort me down the stairs. The pace is leisurely. The lights are on. Despite the fear, how ordinary it is. From here, I can see the clock. It's no time in particular. Nick is no longer with us. He may have gone down the back stairs, not wishing to be seen. Serena Joy stands in the hallway, under the mirror, looking up, incredulous. The commander is behind her. The sitting room door is open. His hair is very gray. He looks worried and helpless, but already withdrawing from me, distancing himself. Whatever else I am to him, I am also at this point a disaster. No doubt they've been having a fight about me. No doubt she's been giving him hell. I still have it in me to feel sorry for him. Moira is right. I am a wimp. What has she done? Says Serena Joy. She wasn't the one who called them then. Whatever she had in store for me, it was more private. We can't say, ma'am, says the one in front of me. Sorry. I need to see your authorization, says the commander. You have a warrant? I could scream now, cling to the banister, relinquish dignity. I could stop them at least for a moment. If they're real, they'll stay. If not, they'll run away, leaving me here. Not that we need one, sir, but all is in order, says the first one again. Violation of state secrets. The commander puts his hand to his head. What have I been saying, and to whom? And which one of his enemies has found out? Possibly he will be a security risk now. I am above him, looking down. He is shrinking. There have already been purges among them. There will be more. Serena Joy goes white. Bitch, she says, after all he did for you. Cora and Rita press through from the kitchen. Cora has begun to cry. I was her hope. I've failed her. Now she will always be childless. The van waits in the driveway. Its double doors stand open. The two of them, one on either side now, take me by the elbows to help me in. Whether this is my end or a new beginning, I have no way of knowing. I have given myself over into the hands of strangers, because it can't be helped. And so I step up, into the darkness within. Or else the light. Historical Notes. Historical Notes on The Handmaid's Tale. Being a partial transcript of the proceedings of the 12th Symposium on Gileadian Studies, held as part of the International Historical Association Convention, held at the University of Denai, Nunavut, on June 25th, 2195. Chair. Professor Marianne Crescent Moon, Department of Caucasian Anthropology, University of Denai, Nunavut. Keynote Speaker. Professor James Darcy Picciotto, Director, 20th and 21st Century Archives, Cambridge University, England. Crescent Moon. I am delighted to welcome you all here this morning, and I'm pleased to see that so many of you have turned out for Professor Picciotto's, I am sure, fascinating and worthwhile talk. We, of the Gileadian Research Association, believe that this period well repays further study, responsible as it ultimately was for redrawing the map of the world, especially in this hemisphere. But before we proceed, a few announcements. The fishing expedition will go forward tomorrow as planned. And for those of you who have not brought suitable rain gear and insect repellent, these are available for a nominal charge at the registration desk. The Nature Walk and Outdoor Period Costume Sing-Song have been rescheduled for the day after tomorrow, as we are assured by our own infallible Professor Johnny Running Dog of a break in the weather at that time. Let me remind you of the other events sponsored by the Gileadian Research Association that are available to you at this convention, as part of our 12th symposium. Tomorrow afternoon, Professor Gopal Chatterjee of the Department of Western Philosophy, University of Baroda, India, will speak on Krishna and Kali elements in the state religion of the early Gilead period. And there is a morning presentation on Thursday by Professor Zieglinda Van Buren from the Department of Military History at the University of San Antonio, Republic of Texas. Professor Van Buren will give what I am sure will be a fascinating illustrated lecture on the Warsaw Tactic, policies of urban core encirclement in the Gileadian Civil Wars. I am sure all of us will wish to attend these. I must also remind our keynote speaker, although I am sure it is not necessary, to keep within his time period, as we wish to leave space for questions, and I expect none of us wants to miss lunch, as happened yesterday. Laughter. Professor Picciotto scarcely needs any introduction, as he is well known to all of us, if not personally, then through his extensive publications. These include Sumptuary Laws Through the Ages, An Analysis of Documents, and the well-known study Iran and Gilead, Two Late 20th Century Monotheocracies, as seen through diaries. As you all know, he is the co-editor, with Professor Notley Wade, also of Cambridge, of the manuscript under consideration today, and was instrumental in its transcription, annotation, and publication. The title of his talk is Problems of Authentication in Reference to The Handmaid's Tale. Professor Picciotto. Applause. Picciotto. Thank you. I am sure we all enjoyed our charming Arctic char last night at dinner, and now we are enjoying an equally charming Arctic chair. I use the word enjoy and two distinct senses, precluding, of course, the obsolete third. Laughter. But let me be serious. I wish, as the title of my little chat implies, to consider some of the problems associated with the soi-disant manuscript, which is well known to all of you by now, and which goes by the title of The Handmaid's Tale. I say soi-disant because what we have before us is not the item in its original form. Strictly speaking, it was not a manuscript at all when first discovered, and bore no title. The superscription The Handmaid's Tale was appended to it by Professor Wade, partly in homage to the great Geoffrey Chaucer. But those of you who know Professor Wade informally, as I do, will understand when I say that I'm sure all puns were intentional, particularly that having to do with the archaic, vulgar signification of the word tale, that being, to some extent, the bone, as it were, of contention, in that phase of Gileadian society of which our saga treats. Laughter. Applause. This item, I hesitate to use the word document, was unearthed on the site of what was once the city of Bangor, in what, at the time prior to the inception of the Gileadian regime, would have been the state of Maine. We know that this city was a prominent way station on what our author refers to as the underground female road, since dubbed by some of our historical wags, the underground frail road. Laughter. Groans. For this reason, our association has taken a particular interest in it. The item in its pristine state consisted of a metal footlocker, U.S. Army issue, circa perhaps 1955. This fact of itself need have no significance, as it is known that such footlockers were frequently sold as army surplus and must therefore have been widespread. Within this footlocker, which was sealed with tape of the kind once used on packages to be sent by post, were approximately 30 tape cassettes, of the type that became obsolete sometime in the 80s or 90s with the advent of the compact disc. I remind you that this was not the first such discovery. You are doubtless familiar, for instance, with the item known as the AB Memoirs, located in a garage in a suburb of Seattle, and with the Diary of P, excavated by accident during the erection of a new meeting house in the vicinity of what was once Syracuse, New York. Professor Wade and I were very excited by this new discovery. Luckily, we had, several years before, with the aid of our excellent resident antiquarian technician, reconstructed a machine capable of playing such tapes, and we immediately set about the painstaking work of transcription. There were some 30 tapes in the collection altogether, with varying proportions of music to spoken word. In general, each tape begins with two or three songs, as camouflage, no doubt. Then the music is broken off and the speaking voice takes over. The voice is a woman's, and according to our voice print experts, the same one throughout. The labels on the cassettes were authentic period labels, dating, of course, from some time before the inception of the early Gilead era, as all such secular music was banned under the regime. There were, for instance, four tapes entitled Elvis Presley's Golden Years, three of Folk Songs of Lithuania, three of Boy George Takes It Off, and two of Mantovani's Mellow Strings, as well as some titles that sported a mere single tape each. Twisted Sisters at Carnegie Hall is one of which I am particularly fond. Although the labels were authentic, they were not always appended to the tape with the corresponding songs. In addition, the tapes were arranged in no particular order, being loose at the bottom of the locker. Nor were they numbered. Thus, it was up to Professor Wade and myself to arrange the blocks of speech in the order in which they appeared to go. But, as I have said elsewhere, all such arrangements are based on some guesswork and are to be regarded as approximate, pending further research. Once we had the transcription in hand, and we had to go over it several times, owing to the difficulties posed by accent, obscure reference, and archaisms, we had to make some decision as to the nature of the material we had thus so laboriously acquired. Several possibilities confronted us. First, the tapes might be a forgery. As you know, there have been several instances of such forgeries, for which publishers have paid large sums, wishing to trade, no doubt, on the sensationalism of such stories. It appears that certain periods of history quickly become, both for other societies and for those that follow them, the stuff of not especially edifying legend, and the occasion for a good deal of hypocritical self-congratulation. If I may be permitted an editorial aside, allow me to say that in my opinion, we must be cautious about passing moral judgment upon the Gileadians. Surely we have learned by now that such judgments are of necessity culture-specific. Also, Gileadian society was under a good deal of pressure, demographic and otherwise, and was subject to factors from which we ourselves are happily more free. Our job is not to censure, but to understand. Applause. To return from my digression, tape like this, however, is very difficult to fake convincingly, and we were assured by the experts who examined them that the physical objects themselves are genuine. Certainly the recording itself, that is, the superimposition of voice upon music tape, could not have been done within the past 150 years. Supposing, then, the tapes to be genuine, what of the nature of the account itself? Obviously, it could not have been recorded during the period of time it recounts, since, if the author is telling the truth, no machine or tapes would have been available to her, nor would she have had a place of concealment for them. Also, there is a certain reflective quality about the narrative that would, to my mind, rule out synchronicity. It has a whiff of emotion recollected, if not in tranquility, at least post facto. If we could establish an identity for the narrator, we felt, we might be well on the way to an explanation of how this document, let me call it that for the sake of brevity, came into being. To do this, we tried two lines of investigation. First, we attempted, through old town plans of Bangor and other remaining documentation, to identify the inhabitants of the house that must have occupied the site of the discovery at about that time. Possibly, we reasoned, this house may have been a safe house on the underground female road during our period, and our author may have been kept hidden in, for instance, the attic or cellar there for some weeks or months, during which she would have had the opportunity to make the recordings. Of course, there was nothing to rule out the possibility that the tapes had been moved to the site in question after they had been made. We hoped to be able to trace and locate the descendants of the hypothetical occupants, whom we hoped might lead us to other material, diaries perhaps, or even family anecdotes passed down through the generations. Unfortunately, this trail led nowhere. Possibly these people, if they had indeed been a link in the underground chain, had been discovered and arrested, in which case any documentation referring to them would have been destroyed. So we pursued a second line of attack. We searched records of the period, trying to correlate known historical personages with the individuals who appear in our author's account. The surviving records of the time are spotty, as the Gileadian regime was in the habit of wiping its own computers and destroying printouts after various purges and internal upheavals. But some printouts remain. Some, indeed, were smuggled to England for propaganda use by the various Save the Women societies, of which there were many in the British Isles at that time. We held out no hope of tracing the narrator herself directly. It was clear from internal evidence that she was among the first wave of women recruited for reproductive purposes and allotted to those who both required such services and could lay claim to them through their position in the elite. The regime created an instant pool of such women by the simple tactic of declaring all second marriages and non-marital liaisons adulterous, arresting the female partners, and, on the grounds that they were morally unfit, confiscating the children they already had, who were adopted by childless couples of the upper echelons who were eager for progeny by any means. In the Middle Period, this policy was extended to cover all marriages not contracted within the state church. Men highly placed in the regime were thus able to pick and choose among women who had demonstrated their reproductive fitness by having produced one or more healthy children, A desirable characteristic in an age of plummeting Caucasian birth rates, a phenomenon observable not only in Gilead, but in most northern Caucasian societies of the time. The reasons for this decline are not altogether clear to us. Some of the failure to reproduce can undoubtedly be traced to the widespread availability of birth control of various kinds, including abortion, in the immediate pre-Gilead period. Some infertility, then, was willed, which may account for the differing statistics among Caucasians and non-Caucasians, but the rest was not. Need I remind you that this was the age of the R-strain syphilis, and also of the infamous AIDS epidemic, which, once they spread to the population at large, eliminated many young sexually active people from the reproductive pool. Stillbirths, miscarriages, and genetic deformities were widespread and on the increase, and this trend has been linked to the various nuclear plant accidents, shutdowns, and incidents of sabotage that characterized the period, as well as to leakages from chemical and biological warfare stockpiles and toxic waste disposal sites, of which there were many thousands, both legal and illegal. In some instances, these materials were simply dumped into the sewage system, and to the uncontrolled use of chemical insecticides, herbicides, and other sprays. But whatever the causes, the effects were noticeable, and the Gilead regime was not the only one to react to them at the time. Romania, for instance, had anticipated Gilead in the 80s by banning all forms of birth control, imposing compulsory pregnancy tests on the female population, and linking promotion and wage increases to fertility. The need for what I may call birth services was already recognized in the pre-Gilead period, where it was being inadequately met by artificial insemination, fertility clinics, and the use of surrogate mothers, who were hired for the purpose. Gilead outlawed the first two as irreligious, but legitimized and enforced the third, which was considered to have biblical precedents. They thus replaced the serial polygamy common in the pre-Gilead period with the older form of simultaneous polygamy practiced both in early Old Testament times and in the former state of Utah in the 19th century. As we know from the study of history, no new system can impose itself upon a previous one without incorporating many of the elements to be found in the latter, as witness the pagan elements in medieval Christianity and the evolution of the Russian KGB from the Tsarist secret service that preceded it. And Gilead was no exception to this rule. Its racist policies, for instance, were firmly rooted in the pre-Gilead period, and racist fears provided some of the emotional fuel that allowed the Gilead takeover to succeed as well as it did. Our author, then, was one of many, and must be seen within the broad outlines of the moment in history of which he was a part. But what else do we know about her, apart from her age, some physical characteristics that could be anyone's, and her place of residence? Not very much. She appears to have been an educated woman, insofar as a graduate of any North American college of the time may be said to have been educated. Laughter. Some groans. But the woods, as you say, were full of these, so that is no help. She does not see fit to supply us with her original name, and indeed all official records of it would have been destroyed upon her entry into the Rachel and Leah Re-Education Center. Of Fred gives no clue, since, like of Glenn and of Warren, it was a patronymic, composed of the possessive preposition and the first name of the gentleman in question. Such names were taken by these women upon their entry into a connection with the household of a specific commander and relinquished by them upon leaving it. The other names in the document are equally useless for the purposes of identification and authentication. Luke and Nick drew blanks, as did Moira and Janine. There is a high probability that these were, in any case, pseudonyms, adopted to protect these individuals should the tapes be discovered. If so, this would substantiate our view that the tapes were made inside the borders of Gilead rather than outside, to be smuggled back for use by the Mayday underground. Elimination of the above possibilities left us with one remaining. If we could identify the elusive commander, we felt, at least some progress would have been made. We argued that such a highly placed individual had probably been a participant in the first of the top-secret Sons of Jacob think tanks, at which the philosophy and social structure of Gilead were hammered out. These were organized shortly after the recognition of the superpower arms stalemate and the signing of the Classified Spheres of Influence Accord, which left the superpowers free to deal, unhampered by interference, with the growing number of rebellions within their own empires. The official records of the Sons of Jacob meetings were destroyed after the Middle Period Great Purge, which discredited and liquidated a number of the original architects of Gilead. But we have access to some information through the diary kept in cipher by Wilfred Limpkin, one of the sociobiologists present. As we know, the sociobiological theory of natural polygamy was used as a scientific justification for some of the odder practices of the regime, just as Darwinism was used by earlier ideologies. From the Limpkin material, we know that there are two possible candidates, that is, two whose names incorporate the element Fred, Frederick R. Waterford, and B. Frederick Judd. No photographs survive of either, although Limpkin describes the latter as a stuffed shirt, and I quote, "somebody for whom foreplay is what you do on a golf course." Laughter. Limpkin himself did not long survive the inception of Gilead, and we have his diary only because he foresaw his own end and placed it with his sister-in-law in Calgary. Waterford and Judd both have characteristics that recommend them to us. Waterford possessed a background in market research and was, according to Limpkin, responsible for the design of the female costumes and for the suggestion that the handmaids wear red, which he seems to have borrowed from the uniforms of German prisoners of war and Canadian POW camps of the Second World War era. He seems to have been the originator of the term participation, which he lifted from an exercise program popular sometime in the last third of the century. The collective rape ceremony, however, was suggested by an English village custom of the 17th century. Salvaging may have been his too, although by the time of Gilead's inception, it had spread from its origin in the Philippines to become a general term for the elimination of one's political enemies. As I have said elsewhere, there was little that was truly original with or indigenous to Gilead. Its genius was synthesis. Judd, on the other hand, seems to have been less interested in packaging and more concerned with tactics. It was he who suggested the use of an obscure CIA pamphlet on the destabilization of foreign governments as a strategic handbook for the Sons of Jacob. And he, too, who drew up the early hit lists of prominent Americans of the time. He also is suspected of having orchestrated the President's Day massacre, which must have required maximum infiltration of the security systems surrounding Congress, and without which the Constitution could never have been suspended. The national homelands and the Jewish boat person plans were both his, as was the idea of privatizing the Jewish repatriation scheme, with the result that more than one boatload of Jews was simply dumped into the Atlantic to maximize profits. From what we know of Judd, this would not have bothered him much. He was a hardliner and is credited by Limpkin with the remark, "Our big mistake was teaching them to read. We won't do that again." It is Judd who is credited with devising the form, as opposed to the name, of the participation ceremony, arguing that it was not only a particularly horrifying and effective way of ridding yourself of subversive elements, but that it would also act as a steam valve for the female elements in Gilead. Scapegoats have been notoriously useful throughout history, and it must have been gratifying for these handmaids, so rigidly controlled at other times, to be able to tear a man apart with their bare hands every once in a while. So popular and effective did this practice become that it was regularized in the Middle Period when it took place 4 times a year on solstices and equinoxes. There are echoes here of the fertility rites of early earth goddess cults. As we heard at the panel discussion yesterday afternoon, Gilead was, although undoubtedly patriarchal in form, occasionally matriarchal in content, like some sectors of the social fabric that gave rise to it. As the architects of Gilead knew, to institute an effective totalitarian system, or indeed any system at all, you must offer some benefits and freedoms, at least to a privileged few, in return for those you remove. In this connection, a few comments upon the crack female control agency known as the Aunts is perhaps in order. Judd, according to the Limpkin material, was of the opinion from the outset that the best and most cost-effective way to control women for reproductive and other purposes was through women themselves. For this, there were many historical precedents. In fact, no empire imposed by force or otherwise has ever been without this feature. Control of the indigenous by members of their own group. In the case of Gilead, there were many women willing to serve as aunts, either because of a genuine belief in what they called traditional values, or for the benefits they might thereby acquire. When power is scarce, a little of it is tempting. There was, too, a negative inducement. Childless or infertile or older women who were not married could take service in the aunts and thereby escape redundancy and consequent shipment to the infamous colonies, which were composed of portable populations used mainly as expendable, toxic cleanup squads. Though, if lucky, you could be assigned to less hazardous tasks, such as cotton picking and fruit harvesting. The idea, then, was Judd's, but the implementation has the mark of Waterford upon it. Who else among the Sons of Jacob think tankers would have come up with the notion that the aunts should take names derived from commercial products available to women in the immediate pre-Gilead period, and thus familiar and reassuring to them? The names of cosmetic lines, cake mixes, frozen desserts, and even medicinal remedies. It was a brilliant stroke, and confirms us in our opinion that Waterford was, in his prime, a man of considerable ingenuity. So, in his own way, was Judd. Both of these gentlemen were known to have been childless, and thus eligible for a succession of handmaids. Professor Wade and I have speculated in our joint paper, The Notion of Seed in Early Gilead, that both, like many of the commanders, had come in contact with a sterility-causing virus that was developed by secret pre-Gilead gene-splicing experiments with mumps, and which was intended for insertion into the supply of caviar used by top officials in Moscow. The experiment was abandoned after the Spheres of Influence Accord, because the virus was considered too uncontrollable and therefore too dangerous by many, although some wished to sprinkle it over India. However, neither Judd nor Waterford was married to a woman who was, or ever had been known, either as Pam or as Serena Joy. This latter appears to have been a somewhat malicious invention by our author. Judd's wife's name was Bambi May, and Waterford's was Thelma. The latter had, however, once worked as a television personality of the type described. We know this from Limpkin, who makes several snide remarks about it. The regime itself took pains to cover up such former lapses from orthodoxy by the spouses of its elite. The evidence, on the whole, favors Waterford. We know, for instance, that he met his end, probably soon after the events our author describes, in one of the earliest purges. He was accused of liberal tendencies, of being in possession of a substantial and unauthorized collection of heretical pictorial and literary materials, and of harboring a subversive. This was before the regime began holding its trials in secret, and was still televising them, so the events were recorded in England via satellite and are on videotape deposit in our archives. The shots of Waterford are not good, but they are clear enough to establish that his hair was indeed gray. As for the subversive Waterford was accused of harboring, this could have been of Fred herself, as her flight would have placed her in this category. More likely it was Nick, who, by the evidence of the very existence of the tapes, must have helped of Fred to escape. The way in which he was able to do this marks him as a member of the shadowy May Day Underground, which was not identical with the Underground Female Road, but had connections with it. The latter was purely a rescue operation, the former quasi-military. A number of May Day operatives are known to have infiltrated the Gileadian power structure at the highest levels, and the placement of one of their members as chauffeur to Waterford would certainly have been a coup. A double coup, as Nick must have been at the same time a member of the Eyes, as such chauffeurs and personal servants often were. Waterford would, of course, have been aware of this, but as all high-level commanders were automatically directors of the Eyes, he would not have paid a great deal of attention to it, and would not have let it interfere with his infraction of what he considered to be minor rules. Like most early Gilead commanders who were later purged, he considered his position to be above attack. The style of Middle Gilead was more cautious. This is our guesswork. Supposing it to be correct, supposing, that is, that Waterford was indeed the commander, many gaps remain. Some of them could have been filled by our anonymous author, had she had a different turn of mind. She could have told us much about the workings of the Gileadian Empire, had she had the instincts of a reporter or a spy. What would we not give now for even 20 pages or so of printout from Waterford's private computer? However, we must be grateful for any crumbs the goddess of history has deigned to vouchsafe us. As for the ultimate fate of our narrator, it remains obscure. Was she smuggled over the border of Gilead into what was then Canada? And did she make her way thence to England? This would have been wise, as the Canada of that time did not wish to antagonize its powerful neighbor, and there were roundups and extraditions of such refugees. If so, why did she not take her taped narrative with her? Perhaps her journey was sudden. Perhaps she feared interception. On the other hand, she may have been recaptured. If she did indeed reach England, why did she not make her story public, as so many did upon reaching the outside world? She may have feared retaliation against Luke, supposing him to have been still alive, which is an improbability, or even against her daughter, for the Gileadian regime was not above such measures, and used them to discourage adverse publicity in foreign countries. More than one incautious refugee was known to receive a hand, ear, or foot, vacuum-packed express, hidden in, for instance, a tin of coffee. Or perhaps she was among those escaped handmaids who had difficulty adjusting to life in the outside world once they got there, after the protected existence they had led. She may have become, like them, a recluse. We do not know. We can only deduce, also, the motivations for Nick's engineering of her escape. We can assume that once her companion of Glenn's association with Mayday had been discovered, he himself was in some jeopardy, for as he well knew, as a member of the Eyes, of Fred herself was certain to be interrogated. The penalties for unauthorized sexual activity with a handmaid were severe, nor would his status as an Eye necessarily protect him. Gilead society was Byzantine in the extreme, and any transgression might be used against one by one's undeclared enemies within the regime. He could, of course, have assassinated her himself, which might have been the wiser course, but the human heart remains a factor, and, as we know, both of them thought she might be pregnant by him. What male of the Gilead period could resist the possibility of fatherhood, so redolent of status, so highly prized? Instead, he called in a rescue team of Eyes, who may or may not have been authentic, but in any case were under his orders. In doing so, he may well have brought about his own downfall. This, too, we shall never know. Did our narrator reach the outside world safely and build a new life for herself? Or was she discovered in her attic hiding place, arrested, sent to the colonies or to Jezebel's, or even executed? Our document, though in its own way eloquent, is on these subjects mute. We may call Eurydice forth from the world of the dead, but we cannot make her answer. And when we turn to look at her, we glimpse her only for a moment, before she slips from our grasp.